And before that, 5,000 years and backwards, was Dvapara Yuga, which was in the 8th, and was way more advanced spiritually and even materially. It's supposed to have been very advanced cultures, fantastic buildings, temple buildings and palaces, and even advanced technology and flying machines and so on, if we are to take actually what is there in the Vedic literatures. On the other hand, we have what we normally read in the history books, and you know, what we are taught in schools is that there was no trace of advanced civilization 10,000 years ago. That's when the first like start of like urban civilizations arose, and then gradually some, you know, still Stone Age cultures are there. Then something like maybe 5,000 years ago, then you get over to what they call the Bronze Age, and you know, this standard scenario that which we're learning, which is kind of the mainstream idea of prehistory. So so what to make of all this? Is recorded in the Vedic literature? Is it just old fantasy mythology, or let's see, what is this here? Yeah, just to start out, this is a picture. He's Danish. That's the main thing. That's why I put him there. And his second qualification, besides being Danish, is that he was the first archaeologist in the world, actually. Christian Jürgensen Thomsen. He was, in the 1700s, beginning of the 1800s. He was the first one. He was a rich merchant, but then as his hobby, he was traveling around in Denmark, and he was making the first archaeological excavations and digging out stone tools and different also bronze implements and so on. The National Museum in Copenhagen was founded by him, by his collections, and that's he's the one who started archaeology, and this whole division of Stone Age, Bronze Age, Iron Age, that goes back to him. He was the one who actually made this division. And although it's about more than 200 years old, it's still clinging on. It's still there, and probably with good reasons, because he was active in a place where probably that fits. I say here in these Scandinavian countries, which were, it seems like they were covered by glaciers, something like 13,000, 15,000, 20,000 years back. Like here, it was like 2 to 3 kilometers of just ice covering this area for who knows how long, 100,000 years maybe, something like that. So, and then somehow or other, these glaciers, they melted, and then the first people who start coming up here were probably like some roaming tribes of hunters and like that. And so, I believe it's a correct description of history in this part of the world of a Stone Age, Bronze Age, Iron Age. But what is debatable is that this kind of paradigm has been tried to force fit into the whole world history. That's actually what has happened. And is that actually a correct? We're going to look at that if that actually fits to the whole world. Because of course the Vedic scriptures will say that doesn't fit there. Here is. So that's the general idea. Stone Age, where people living like hunters and gatherers and collecting some stones and chipping off a few edges on the stones and having campfires and like that, something like that. Maybe like that. Who knows? Maybe it was something like that also. who knows what happened. It could also be that. I mean, actually, because he had actually some quite advanced civilization even that time. But maybe it was like that. Who knows? Here is some, just to contrast this with what is, the Vedic scriptures. These are quotes from Srila Prabhupada, who writes in his purports to the Srimad Bhagavatam, "It is understood that not only at the present moment, but in those days, there were also skyscrapers." Here you find the word Hamya Priste. Hamya means a very big palatial building. Svahvimanat means from his own airplane. It is suggested that private airplanes or helicopters were also current in those days. So those days, that's something unspecified, hundreds of thousands of millions of years back. This is a long quote. I'm not going to read it all, but it's stated in Srimad Bhagavatam. I think, can we have the kids go outside and play? Or be quiet? Harold, can you tell either kids should go out and play, or they should be quiet inside? So it's stated in Srimad Bhagavatam that this new well-constructed city developed within the sea had regular planned roads, streets and lanes. There were also well-planned parks and gardens filled with plants known as kalpavrikshas or desire trees. I get distracted by it. Ina, can you tell the kids?
I told them I took out, but...
Isn't there a mother around?
But so.
Yeah.
Mother, she's mother.
So, sorry about that. So it says there were also well-planned parks and gardens filled with plants known as kalpavrikshas or desire trees. These desire trees are not like the ordinary trees of the material world. The desire trees are found in the spiritual world. By Krishna's supreme will, everything is possible. So such desire trees were planted in Dvaraka, the city constructed by Krishna. The city was also filled with many palaces and gopuras, or big gates. These gopuras are still found in some of the larger temples. They are very high and constructed with fine artistic skill. Such palaces and gates held golden water pots. These water pots on the gates or in the palaces are considered auspicious signs. Almost all the palaces were skyscrapers. So this is a description of the city of Dvaraka that Krishna he built 5,000 years ago. According to the Vedic scriptures, it was 5,000 years ago. And in the end, I'm going to discuss actually the dating of the Dvaraka and places like that. Modern scholars, they will question that it's that old, but according to the
Vedas. Isn't the Veda much, much older?
It's much older, but it was written down 5,000 years ago. Yeah. But definitely the scripture, the knowledge is much, much older, according to itself, yeah.
So it mentions, as I quite recall, a river in India that is now completely
Sarasvati? Yeah. So that's I'm not sure if I'll get on, but it's... we'll see how much time we have.
Yeah.
But the river Saraswati is a very interesting thing. It's mentioned in the Vedas. There's no river Saraswati now. But it turns out actually there was a river flowing 6,000-8,000 years. Enormous river, bigger than any Ganges, Indus of nowadays actually. So and I'm not going to read the whole thing here, but here Prabhupada writes that Vedic culture were not only in India, it was all over the world. All over the world, all over Asia, all over Europe, Africa, America was covered by Vedic culture. So I'm going to look at some of these. Here is a, I don't know, it's a little hard to see. This is a painting of a description of Dvaraka, just to contrast the other painting of the Stone Age. You have to remember both are paintings from someone's mind. The Stone Age pictures are not video recordings of Stone Age people. It's just in someone's mind. It's actually fantasy. It might be correct fantasy, but it's fantasy. So this is similar from the mind of the artist after reading descriptions of Dwarka. So we're going to have a look at it. Did we have a real advanced culture, or did we have or just some Stone Age people? Can we find evidence for a worldwide Vedic culture in prehistorical times? So I'm trying to look at some of that. And here we have our friend here. He's also seen what he can find. And actually, probably when we look, I concluded actually that Stone Age is actually a very good term for Dwapara Yuga. I think actually it's correct to say Dwapara Yuga was definitely a Stone Age. And let's have a look here. We can start out with this. Here's a stone. Can you see that? Who knows where we are?
Well, I don't remember exactly.
Baalbek, you're right. This is Baalbek.
But I was going to mention that, the scientists believe that some Romans, that giant stone, and they can't figure out what it is.
Yeah. This is one of the biggest megaliths found anywhere in the world. It's called the Stone of a Pregnant Woman. It's situated in Baalbek in Lebanon, in very northeastern corner, almost close to Syria, where there is now it's a big temple complex of Apollon, a Roman temple complex, where the upper portion and the temple of Apollo is built in typical Roman style with stone blocks, not enormous stone blocks, stone blocks that can be handled by the Romans could handle, and they were very good at building in very impressive structures. But under the Roman structure, then there is something else. Archaeologists say this is also Roman, and this is also Roman, but there's no evidence Romans did not have the capacity to move this stone. Weighs something like 1,100 tons. You have one. Can you see there was one man standing on this stone? It's 1,100 tons. It has not been moved. It appears this is situated in the quarry, but three other massive stones. I don't know if you can see. They are in the foundation wall of this Apollon temple. And you see here are these three massive stones, each weighing 800 tons. Each of them has been moved at least 1 kilometer from this quarry and lifted up something like 6 meters above the ground, put in the foundation, fit together so perfectly you cannot even put a piece of paper in between them. That's astounding. And how it was possible, it's a mystery how they could do it. I know until 1970 we did not have cranes or anything that could lift more than 400 tons. Now we have cranes that can lift considerably more, but then again that's first of all takes a lot of technology, and also the whole area, the foundation has to be really prepared and compacted and so on to even lift or bear such weights. I mean, if you even tried to pull such a stone on some kind of that rolls across over the ground, it would just sink into the ground. 800 tons is enormous. And there's no evidence that the stretch between the quarry and where the temple is in any way has been prepared for carrying such heavy weights. How did they do it? And these enormous stones they found everywhere all over the world. And how old they are, we don't know. I mean, this one, they say it's Romans, evidence Romans could lift anything like that. And if it was Romans, why in Baalbek? I mean, that was in the very outskirts of the Roman Empire. Why not Rome? Because this is impressive. if they could make impressive things like that, why didn't they do it in the capital in Rome? But they had nothing like that in Rome. They had it, I think the Romans tried to move some of the Egyptians what's called obelisks. I think that, and even like 70 tons was almost impossible for the Romans to move, for to speak, of these 800 tons. And you find actually these stones like that all over the world. They found, you know, if you start looking, but it's there. Someone has been able to not only to move, but also to prepare, to cut, and to fit precisely together stones of an enormous sizes that we would even have difficulty moving today or cutting today with our modern technology. For example, go to South America. This is called Sacsayhuaman in Peru. Peru especially has many megalithic sites like this. Some of these stones are several hundred tons. And if you can also get an idea how precisely they fit together, they're so precisely cut together. And the thing is, and they even, you see, somewhere you have stones that are, you know, okay, they are, they have cut them out with many, many corners and edges and still fitting them precisely together. How do you do that? I mean, here is. Can you see? Is it too much light in here, or is it difficult to see? Can you see it? This is Cusco, again Peru, very famous street there. This is also from Cusco. This stone here is famous. It has, I think, say 12 corners, has been cut out like this, and it's. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing stonework, and the stones are massive, and the way they fit together, and how they're moved. Many of them, they have been moved, several kilometers, sometimes 50, 100 kilometers, and we in the Andes, it's very rugged, you know, it's up mountains and down mountains, and you know, how did they move them? And they say, standard historians say, Incas did this. These were Incas, but Incas are very recent. And when you really look at it, there's no evidence Incas were able to have. The real evidence actually points to that the Incas, they came and they just they built on top of what was already there. I don't know if you can really tell here. But up here in the top. Is, I mean, here and below are these enormous stones in this wall in the street in Cusco. Up further here, it's filled out with a lot of minor stones, stonework. So that seems it's obvious. We're dealing with two different cultures. Mm-hmm. The Incas, they built what filled up on top, and this is from some previous civilization of actually unknown age. So that's found everywhere. I mean, many, many places in the world, these enormous stones, you find them. Let's see what happened here. This is, again, Ollantaytambo, Peru, another place on Megaliths. Find them in, of course, Egypt. I'll come back a little to look at Egypt also. Egypt has it in... you find it in the in Europe, Malta, Greece, places in Russia. You find it in the Far East. You find it in even Japan has it, and someone has found it even in New Zealand. But it's not really been accepted because they're not supposed to have been people in New Zealand 20,000 years ago. But there are, you might say, alternative archaeologists who actually found megalith even on New Zealand. Dating back 20,000 years ago, so I mean there is apparently there were an advanced civilization somewhere in prehistoric times that were able to move and work with stones on the size that you know We cannot even understand how they were doing it. Come to India. India has also many megalithic stones like that. And I'm going to show one example here. This is from Brihadeshwara temple. You know the Brihadeshwara? Probably Tanjore. Is that Tamil Nadu? So 130,000 tons of granite moved is also quite an accomplishment. And the real impressive thing is the top, the dome on the top, which is one massive stone, you can all read what I said there. The Gopuram here at the top weighs, it's one big granite, piece of granite weighing 80 tons, which has been lifted 66 meters up on top and placed there. That's also quite impressive. Okay, 80 tons is not 800 tons, but 66 meters, it's a... You're a mechanical engineer. You're an engineer.
Chemical, yeah.
Chemical? Oh, okay. Sorry. But I think even modern engineers would have a hard time getting 80 tons up in 66 meters above the ground without modern cranes. You know, some... there are... India has... And I'm going to have more looks at some amazing things from India. The degree of intricacy of stonework in India excels anything found anywhere else in the world. I mean, you also have very massive stones. I can show that you have one place that has 1,700 ton stones in India, but that's not very carved. But in India, you have such intricate stoneworks. It's a mystery how it was done. And but here's one example of something that also is evidence of very advanced technology found all over the world. Here is, I don't know if you can tell, these are two massive stones, and they are on the side of each stone is cut out what they call the keystone cut. This in one stone and a similar cut in the other stone, and then on the flat surface that two stones fit together, here this on the flat surface, then the builders have poured liquid metals into here, which immediately solidifies and hold them together. You get it?
Mm.
But how that works? That's quite advanced. Just even the concept of binding stones together like that, and that means someone had portable metal smelters that they and could. I mean, some of the. The metals that they have analyzed that were, you know, were used for these clamps contain, what was it? It was at least metals with very high melting point. Was it tin? And now I don't remember. I think there's one article is coming here about that. There's even traces of platinum in some of it, which is, you know, how did they know platinum that in those days? these are found all over the world. As you can see here, from Angkor Wat, from Denvera in Egypt, or from Ollantaytambo in Peru, from Tiahuanaco in Bolivia. Also, they have them in, found them in Vietnam, also in Greece. Very, I mean, it's very particular. I mean, and so, did, so the question is there. First of all, how could primitive cultures do something like that, and how could they independently come up with this technique all over the world if there was not, if there were not, like a worldwide cultural influence of one united culture? How you know? So that then they must have independently come up with this technology. Does that make sense? So. And here there's more discussions on these keystone clamps. Just an, as an example, here are some of the places where you find them. So Peru, Bolivia, and I think Sardinia, Greece, Egypt, Persia, India, Vietnam, places like that. Found everywhere. What's next then? Yeah, more about them when we find them. You see, so many places that find this, this technology as well. Yeah, Egypt, of course, is fascinating, and I guess I could just give a lecture on pyramids, and that in itself should be enough to convince everyone that we are not dealing with primitive cultures. So I'll skip the pyramids because we all know the pyramids and like that. And Egypt has so much. I mean, I don't think anyone is even aware of how much is from prehistory you find in Egypt. I've picked out a couple examples showing evidence of very advanced culture and very old culture too. Let's see here. Yeah, I guess to wind back. We're first going to a place called Saqqara, where there is, first of all, there's a very famous, what's called the Step Pyramid at Saqqara, but also they found a very extensive tunnel system at Saqqara, where there are some very mysterious stone coffins inside chambers. Stone coffins which are weighing about 100 tons each, which has been transported. The granite is from Aswan, 1,000 kilometers away. It has been transported 1,000 kilometers, and then it has been somehow or other moved down into these underground tunnel chambers and placed there. And why wouldn't, I mean, of course, how could it be done, and why would anyone do it? These are the big questions. So there's something here about that. It's
within the tunnel. We got it in box that weighs 10 pounds. We have created a lot that weighs 50 pounds, at least 2,000 meters.
Yeah.
And there's no
power
box installed over here. We was going to make all the difference. What we see here was not together. Because you can't accomplish lots of work in the open with the right amount of feet. Because for that, 2,000 people to drag a block of stone is not a possible job. But to have this done inside the tunnel, that's crazy.
So are all these in the original place?
Yeah.
Yeah. So how we know this is here?
So we can see here one of the boxes of the Sarapino rock. It was the rough surface. If we follow the Egyptological way of polishing this one,
then we will be having few men with sand and rocks polishing the surface. If this works in a way, there's still no space for these men to work. So when we see the other ones also inside the chambers that's finished, how would this be finished if you don't have space for the people to be working around? Basic and simple.
So here Yosef is one where the lid has been slid back.
Yeah.
And again, it's believed that the boxes themselves weigh how much?
70 tons for the box and 30 tons for the lid. So the total of 100 tons for the box and the lid in the range.
And this is not local stone?
No, this is not local stone.
Where was it brought from, do you think?
It's not closer than Aswan, which is 1,000 kilometers from here.
Well, as you've heard Yusuf say, the box and the lid, of which there are more than 20 of them, each one in its recess, weighs about 100 tons. The stone is from at least 1,000 kilometers away, and yet the official statement is that these were made during dynastic times, the late period, as burials for sacred bulls, the Apis bull. However, the level of tolerance and engineering and finish in this incredibly hard stone, which the dynastic Egyptians did not have the tools to shape it, tells us that we're looking at an older construction than what Egyptologists say, from probably several thousand years ago. And the only way that these boxes were quarried, moved, and put into place underground here and finished would have been using forms of technology that not only the ancient dynastic Egyptians did not have, but that we also do not have to this day.
No. That's what I mean. It's we in the Stone Age. This is really Stone Age. And yeah, how it was done is absolutely fantastic. Here is another example. Some say that this vase is just as a big mystery as the pyramids. Doesn't look much, but as far as I know, they were found in the same system of tunnels as we just looked at the Sagara. Hundreds of vases, which is it's one piece of stone, and they have been hollowed out and carved and hollowed out into these amazing stone vases. And this is not even the best example. There are vases which are have bodies like a goose or a swan, very thin neck, then a big body like that, and then the inside is hollowed out, and they are in complete balance. I mean, you just the bottom is round. You put them, they stand, they don't tip like that. That means they are the way they have been hollowed out is extremely precise. Otherwise, they couldn't have. Yeah, we couldn't do that today. How do you get down a small, narrow like that and then hollow out inside? Another thing is we could hear this is of course Sphinx, very very famous, and the standard history is that the Sphinx is around 5,000 years old, same as the pyramids, which they also date to something like 5,000 years ago, which I also think of course is debatable, but I'm not, I decided not to even discuss pyramids here. And you're never going to stop if you start discussing pyramids. But Sphinx is also said to be 5,000 years old. Therefore, it was caused quite a stir and quite a controversy when in 1992, one professional geologist, Robert Schock, he went there, and he had a look at the Sphinx and the body of the Sphinx. And what he found was that actually the body of the Sphinx is severely eroded by heavy rains. That's, and it's not even very subtle, it's very obvious, but nobody has really drawn a conclusion from that. You see that the rains have been, you know, pouring down over the body of Sphinx and caused severe erosion on the body of it. And and he said that this means it must be vastly older, because for the last 5,000 years there has not been rains in Egypt. It has been very dry. You have to go back 9,000, 10,000, 12,000 years old. The climate, that time the climate was different. But it's, so it's definitely that older, and that old and probably older. And when he published that, at first actually the geologists, the first time he presented that was at in the U.S. at like the American Geological Society, like their annual conference, and all the geologists, they just applauded. This is first class. This is really, I mean, it's obvious. It's clear to all the geologists. Afterwards, then it started again. The archaeologists became aware of this, and it came up in the yearly annual meeting of the what is called American Association for the Advancement of Science, top American scientific institution or society. Their yearly meeting, and there again he was meant to present it, and then also some archaeologists would be there, but they had arranged in a way so, well, he would present a little and then the archaeologists would get the last word, and he would actually want complete blast, and that's what happened. And he was his whole idea was ridiculed and rejected. So that in the beginning of the 90s that caused quite a stir, and but the archaeologists did not accept it. But still, however, it also seems that that event caused very much the start of, like you mentioned, Hancock, alternative archaeologists. There's a whole movement of alternative archaeologists nowadays. And it seems this event definitely, you know, caught the attention of quite many, and they started really looking into many more anomalies around the world. So, but the Sphinx, aside from that, I mean, there's so much about the Sphinx that actually points to that it dates from a much earlier age. Also, the way that it's pointed, I mean, it's facing directly east, and it's a lion, and there's a whole discussion here. Of course, it has the face of a human now. Probably it had a lion's face earlier, and later on it was... maybe that face somehow or other eroded, and then it was repaired, and it got a human face, because a human face doesn't fit the body, it's too small for the rest of the body. So many things, it had a lion face. So it's a lion moving due east. Now you have to know something about astrology and astronomy to know what that means. It could be interpreted as this lion represents the star constellation Leo, the lion. Again, in astrology, astrological times, the age of Leo, the age of lion, was 12,000 years ago, not 5,000 years ago. So anyway, I mean, there are those who get long, you know, arguments and why this, that, why it seems like actually it was a lion facing the constellation of lion when the age of lion or Leo, the.
So 12,000 years ago,
yeah.
The Sphinx would have faced directly east and met.
The lion.
The Leo constellation over the horizon.
Yeah, on the spring equinox.
Yeah.
The starting point in astrological time is when you have the equinox in springtime. That means when the sun rises, and the sun is in the sign of Leo. So that, you know, so they are on in spring equinox, which is like in like the 23rd of March, 12,000 years ago, when the sun was rising exactly in the east, then it would be there in the sign of Leo, the lion. So it's it, the idea with the Sphinx, it appears, was, well, we're in the age of lion, the lion is looking directly at the lion, something like that. So there's been, you know, again, alternative archaeologists arguing this is actually the real symbolism found in the Sphinx. So there are different, there's much evidence that points to that it's quite old. Of course, archaeologists, they object to this. And the main objection to Robert Schoch's proposal that the Sphinx is much older, even 12,000 years old, was we don't know of any, there was no civilization that could have built anything like that. If there had been civilization, that would that be that advanced, we would have found it. Well, why should they build a Sphinx but nothing else, and we don't find it, and that's why they rejected it. So, but that's of course an interesting thing. That was in 1992 they made that. Actually, that's not valid anymore. They have since then found, and my opinion is actually they have already found it many times, but they don't see it. They don't see the forest for trees. Just like you see, so the Baalbek. It's obvious this is not the Romans, but somehow they have force fit the ideas into whatever they find, therefore they don't see it. But even if they had not found it, now they have found it. Since then, they have found very advanced civilization dating back 12,000 years, and even mainstream archaeologists are accepting that. And that's the discovery of a site in Turkey called Göbekli Tepe. How many have heard of that? You have heard of that? It's quite known, isn't it? So that was discovered, I think, in the beginning, started in the 90s, and excavations really took place in, was in 2003-04 onwards. One German archaeologist, Klaus Schmidt, was ahead, you know, he was just a classic mainstream archaeologist. And there they found, let's see, another megalithic site. When they started excavating, they thought it would be some, that might be something like 800 or 1,000 years old, but it turned out it's a 12,000 year old site of with megalithic stones arranged in circles, little like Stonehenge, but much more intricate, much more advanced stonework than you find in Stonehenge. Stones weighing in average 5 tons up to 50 tons. With beautiful carvings and, you know, very intricate stonework. How big is the site?
It covers at least several football fields.
Yeah.
And it's largely unexcavated. It's
yeah, so
only a small bit that has been uncovered.
Yeah. They have, you know, been out there with their whatever, they know there's much more
radar equipment, underground radar,
and there's much more, but there's so far it's only a small fraction that is
it's like an entire hill,
that's
what's called Göbekli Tepe means in Turkish, it's a hill.
Oh, that just means hill, okay.
No, not just hill, but like the hill, it's in the name, because the entire hill is the site.
Yeah.
And if you have escaped the entire hill, you get all the monoliths.
Okay, yeah. So it was absolute sensation when they found that, and it really resets all ideas about prehistory. It still haven't, you know, really, I mean, who built it, and the purpose, and so on. I mean, it's very much, you know, up in the open what was going on. But they found this very incredible site. Here is is a Klaus Schmidt. Here is idea of what is, I don't know if this is the just what they've excavated or what they've...
Just what's excavated.
This is just what has been excavated so far, yeah. And what's interesting is that it's 12,000 years old and then 8,000...
At least 12,000, that's a minimum.
Yeah, could be older.
It's probably much older than
yeah.
that, but that's like the minimum carbon dating.
Yeah, yeah.
Date.
Yeah, because it's not built in just in 1 year like that, it's built over probably centuries, something like that.
Yeah, plus you have limitation to our dating technology.
Yeah, yeah.
That we don't see the maximum age.
No.
When we use our dating technology, we only see
minimum age. Yeah, yeah, true.
So it's
within a, it's more like within a certain time span.
Yeah.
Minimum this, maximum that, something
yeah.
like that. And it could easily be much older. But also what is interesting is that not only was it built minimum 12,000 years ago, old 12,000 years ago, but also the whole place was again buried deliberately 8,000 years ago.
Why?
Yeah, it's not. I mean, it's not. You know, it has not that naturally been covered by sand, like the Sphinx. If you don't constantly excavate the Sphinx, you'll soon disappear into the sand. But this is on the top of the hill, so that doesn't, you know, sand get sanded like that. Here it was deliberately, the whole place has been again filled up and hit away. That is also an enormous feat. How do you move so much earth? Why? And so it's a very mystical place. Very mystical place. Another amazing place that has been discovered in within the last since 2000, and that's, it's so controversial that even most alternative archaeologists will not accept it. Yeah. Even I know even Graham Hancock says this is not a real archaeological site, but no, this is accepted by everyone. Next one I'm going to show you is not accepted by even, but I accept it because I've been there to the next place.
But not even Ram Hancock.
Yeah, and next time, if I get a chance, I want to speak with him about it. Because it's absolutely, and we're going to look at some pyramids. And so where are the biggest pyramids in the world? What is the biggest pyramid?
South America?
No.
Serbia.
Almost. Close. Not Serbia, but
okay.
Bosnia.
Bosnia.
I was there in Bosnia. It's I went there with Svita Krishna Swami from Sweden. I know how many know. Do you know him?
No, I haven't.
Okay. You know him. So him and I went there. So I have some pictures from the trip, and that is also an amazing place. This is just from a poster. Here's Smita Krishnaswamy is looking at this is a of the oh this is a poster of the biggest of the Bosnian pyramids called the Pyramid of the Sun, which is 225 meters tall. The big pyramid in Egypt, the Cheops pyramid, is 165 meters tall, but this one is 225 meters tall. The second pyramid in Bosnia is called the Pyramid of the Moon, that's 190 meters tall. And so what are the pyramids in Bosnia? Well, they are, you find them in a mountainous area south of Sarajevo, in a place called Visoko. And I mean, it's a hilly area, mountains and like that, covered with forests, and there you have these also, they very much look like the pyramid shapes. I mean, they have four sides like pyramids, they are, you know, built, or they're there according to the cardinal directions, like that, and locals have called them pyramids, but most of them are not pyramids, they're just natural hills. One Bosnian amateur archaeologist started looking at it. He himself has specialized pyramids, so he's traveled all over the world looking at pyramids. And he started looking at these and said, they're not natural hills, they are pyramids. And And then excavations have started, and it's a fact. You find actually under them there is stonework. You can see actually there's construction there. They actually constructed, and they're controversial because now the dating goes back at least minimum 15 and probably up to 26,000 years back. You had a question.
What were they used for? Was it a burial site, or was it for religious service to Surya?
No idea.
No idea.
And
like for example, you don't contribute that many resources like you did with the pyramid to bury a dead king.
It's just completely.
So it must have been used for something else.
Yeah.
Maybe you bury a king, but the main purpose must be something else.
Yeah, but they never found
something. Something that has a motivation that we, in our materialistic mind, cannot comprehend.
Yeah. I mean, there are theories like that, and maybe someone say they actually were power plants for subtle energies, and they had technology where you can use that. And generated that into actual energy.
To me, that even sounds more probable than not only a burial.
Yeah. But the plain answer is that, I don't think, at least, I don't know. Like, also, they call it, in this Bosnian, it's a pyramid of the moon and the pyramid of the sun. These are just names that we have given, that has been given now. I mean, it's not the original names. This is lost in forgetfulness, actually, where who has built, nobody has any idea. They're mentioned by the Greek historian Plinius.
Could it be used for temple worship?
Could be anything. Yeah. And
did you mention any hard evidence? When I was up with the kids, is there any hard evidence?
Of the Bosnian pyramids? Yeah. Very hard. Here, of course, and you can see here, and this is Smita Krishnaswamy looking over from the top of the sun pyramid. And here we are, here excavations are taking place. And when you uncover this is from the pyramid of the moon. And as you remove, there's like several meters of just soil. When you remove at a certain point, you come down to this stonework here. And this pyramid of the moon is actually a step pyramid. You find these platforms, or around on it everywhere. This is not natural. I think you can see that.
But there are still like conventional scientists that do not accept this.
They do not accept it.
Right.
Conventional scientists.
Yeah. You can go to Wikipedia.
Yeah.
You're going to Wikipedia and see Bosnian pyramid. Say it's a pseudo archaeological site and like that. But I just know because I took these pictures, and I mean, there's no question about it. These are absolute pyramids, and you see the stonework like that. I have a whole, I could show you, I have hundreds of pictures I took there. I'm just giving you an idea. The top of the top of this pyramid, when you remove the soil again, there's whole places just paved with stones and like that. It's interesting. Both the pyramids are interesting, and the reaction from the archaeologists is also very interesting.
Did you also go the tunnel inside?
I was also in tunnels. Yeah, they found a whole tunnel system. Yeah, and they are supposed to be. They were filled up 5,000 years ago, they say, and before that they were. Yeah, so I was in the tunnels also. So they're still excavating the tunnels. They have only, 1 kilometer they have excavated. When I was there, there's a date on there. You can see the date, 2000. I was there in July 2013. So, they are, and so on. But say Plinius, the Roman historian, he mentions and he talks about the pyramids of the Titans. There's a place where he mentions that. So it was known in the antique there were pyramids there, but then somehow or other has been.
So ancient historians.
Yeah, they're talking about the
like Plato would talk about the Atlantis.
Yep. Yeah. So. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, just to give you, you could again, it could be a whole lecture just on Boston pyramids also.
But the Titans, they were ancient gods. Who do they correspond to in the
Vedic? I don't know, but Titans in this context means the people who have Titans. They also, at least maybe a source of Titans. Maybe it also refers to the some gods or something like that. In the Vedas, I have no idea.
Sorry for being critical again.
No, that's fine.
I just want some kind of inconclusive, some hard evidence that's like just throws away the debate, because the conventional scientists will say that this is some kind of structure, natural structure, and
I mean, but this cannot be natural structure. Just the fact that the sites are equal site, they are. No, and they're pointing to the precisely to the direction. Actually, the Boston pyramids are more precisely aligned to the directions than the Egyptian pyramids. I mean, the Egyptian pyramids are very precise. We've had time being that precise. Boston pyramids are even more precise, aligned according to the cardinal directions, like that. I mean, the hard evidences. Well, you know, you need two kinds of hard evidences. I say one is just go there. And the other is that conventional archaeologists, they just have to die. And some new cultures have, you know, because they're not going to change. I don't know.
But they will if you have some kind of.
They can go there. They can go there and look for themselves.
No, I don't think so. Some of these people, you show them something that's absolutely inconclusive, but they're so vested with their ideology and their identity is so vested into their worldview that they will die before changing their minds.
You
people
are
there are archaeologists. Some of there was one prominent Egyptian archaeologist. He went to Boston Pyramid. He said, "Of course, the pyramids." Then when he came back, he was fired. It's not that there are no archaeologists, but just the official position is they're not pyramids. And how, I mean.
But look at the picture.
Yeah.
This is man-made.
Absolutely.
Yes, and believe me, I've studied this more than most people out there.
Yeah, yeah.
And read Hancock's books and all that.
Yeah.
But
anyway, I mean, it's a huge topic, and so.
Indeed.
I'm jumping to India. Yeah, there's some interesting things in India, also some enormous stones in India. I'm going to give you two examples of even bigger stones. The first one, I mean, you remember the stone of the pregnant woman was 1,100 tons. Now we in India, here's a stone that weighs 1,700 tons.
Mahabalipuram in India, and let's take a look at this unexplainable rock structure called Bhima Stove. Locals believe that it was built by a giant who was more than 12 feet tall, and I will show you some solid evidence that it was in fact built by a giant. But first, let's see if this structure could have been built by humans at all. The specialty of this structure is that the rock on the left, which weighs a massive 1,700 tons, has been lifted and made to lean on a relatively smaller rock on the right. Archaeologists and geologists agree that this is not a natural formation.
That's one example, Mahabalipuram in South India. Mm. And same place, Mahabalipuram, there's another very interesting thing.
Hey guys, we are at Mahabalipuram in India, and let's take a look at this mysterious giant rock called Krishna's Butterball. The specialty of this rock is that it stands on an extremely small base, less than 2 square feet area, on a slippery hill. Just imagine what would happen if you place a ball on a slope. It would roll down right away, but this rock has been in place for at least 1,200 years. This granite rock is over 20 feet tall and weighs over 250 tons. With its width almost equal to its height, it looks like a sphere in some angles, but it's not a perfect sphere. You can see a lot of people sitting under it, which gives you an idea of how big it is. Many people think of this rock as a natural formation. However, such a natural formation is impossible because there's no way it would have come to this shape by erosion, flowing water, or blowing wind. You can see that the rest of the area is a smooth hill and is devoid of any other large rocks. So if it's not a natural formation, who could have put it here? Even in modern days, moving a 250-ton rock uphill would be a very difficult task and require complex equipment like cranes. How was it done 1,200 years ago?
And anyway, he says 1,200. These dates, I mean, let's forget about these dates. They don't even know how old it is. It's interesting that in the 1930s, the English governor of Tamil Nadu thought that this is just too dangerous. You know, it's just one time suddenly this stone is going to roll down and a lot of people are going to get killed by it. So let's remove it. So he had actually he started trying to move that stone. He couldn't. He had to give up. He can't move it.
Which year was that?
In the 1930s, sometimes. I don't know exactly which year, but it was in the
1930s. Today they can move it? Or
No, you can't. I mean, it's there.
They're able to move it today, probably.
I mean, you could, maybe if you moved in enormous, you know, several cranes and like that, you could, but, I mean, but it's not something, it doesn't, you cannot just push it down.
It wasn't done.
Maybe dynamite.
Then you can move.
So what's next? Let's just give. I mean, there's so many places all over the world which are also inexplainable. This is an interesting place. This is called Nan Madol. This is found on an island called Pohnpei in what is Micronesia. If you know, Micronesia is in the Pacific, in the West Pacific, north of Guinea, New Guinea, and it's a very small island. And there, on that, not on the island, but on the coast and out into the water, is built like an artificial city. At some point, actually, again, dating it is, they give a very fairly recent age, like 1,100 years ago, but really they're not able to date it. It's it covers like 75 acres. 700 tons of stone has been moved, weighing 55 tons up to, I think, 50 tons, and it's a whole megalithic stone city, artificial, with artificial islands and everything, built by, let's see here, you can see kind of these are just big basalt blocks, stone blocks, you know, built like in America they would build log cabins here, that same thing, but with massive stones that put together like that.
Prabhu, they say that these small stones, they're all weighing minimum 5 tons. Is that correct?
I think something like that. they're not that small. Not that small. And Pohnpei is a fairly small island. What more is, there is no basalt on that island. The stone is not from this island. Mm-hmm. That means so where does it come from? Actually, they don't know where it's come from. Mm-hmm. Who would sail stones across the ocean and from somewhere like that? They dated it until, or give the dates of like 1,100 years ago. However, Hancock, was diving off there, and he found actually it's the city continues underwater, quite, you know, quite deep down, which means actually it must be much older.
There are underwater structures found outside the coast of Japan.
Also, yeah. Also outside India, also in Europe, in outside. I mean, actually, they are found many places. And when you talk about flooded structures, flooded cities, that means that, you know, of course, depending on how deep it is, then you can put dates on the ocean sea level was is nowadays 120 meters above what it was 20,000 years ago. And but after the ice age and the melting of all the glaciers, after on the ice age, the sea level has risen 120 meters. The rise of sea level stopped something like, I mean, they say, I think it's like 8,000 years ago, something like that. Could be, I mean, we don't know, but there are, of course, we have histories and stories of flooded cities, flooded continents everywhere. And then you have, if you dive off many places, you actually find flooded, you know, city, you know, buildings and like that. And they must be very old.
In the Pacific, you have Lemuria. The ancient tales of Lemuria.
Yeah.
The lost continent. And they say it should be like something like 800,000 years ago or something like 800,000. That.
800,000?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's interesting. The structure of Japan was, it's so deep that it's like very, very, very long time ago. It's not... It's not only 20,000, it's probably more than 20,000, like
okay.
Maybe 100,000 or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. I think Hancock talks about 12,000 years for that also.
But Lemuria is a legend.
Yeah.
And, same as Atlantis, the same type of legend, but one is Atlantic Ocean, the other is the Pacific Ocean.
Mm. Like if you. The amount of land that has disappeared. Is something like you know, from 20,000 years until now, something like more. It's more than the area of entire South America that is now on the ocean. India has many places. You know, we know Dwarka. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Dwarka disappeared into the ocean, and there are, and Dwarka. If you dive outside Dwarka, you find actually there's a lost city out there also. And so anyway, just one more example. I'm just giving a few examples, and it's just the top of the iceberg. I mean, there's so much everywhere.
Ramsetu. Connecting India and Sri Lanka.
But Lanka is also, the Lanka of today, actually it was not supposed to be Ravana's Lanka. Ravana's Lanka has sunk into the ocean, and was Hanuman, he jumps, was 100 Yodhanas. So there's not 100 Yodhanas from India to Lanka, it's much further down.
Okay.
So I'm not sure exactly how the Ramsetu, how to fit that into the picture, but maybe someone else built the bridge. Someone has built the bridge, that's clear.
Yeah, and also... It said the stones seem to have been moved, they don't belong there.
Okay, yeah. So it's, India has so many incredible things. Here's one more thing from India. We're going to Kanchipuram.
Based on a tip, I traveled to Kanchipuram, which is 300 miles from Hampi. And here, we can see the chains hanging from the hooks on the corners of the ceiling. Yes, these chains, with many links, are in fact made of stone. Archaeologists have confirmed that these are made of stone and were created at least 700 years ago. How could anyone create these stone chains with primitive tools? Even today, such a technology is not possible with modern machines. What kind of machines were used in ancient times, and how were they able to create these chains made of rock? But this is not even the main problem. The problem is that while the stone chains are made of sandstone, the ceiling is made of granite blocks. So how could they connect two different types of rocks at this junction? We know for a fact that this is impossible without melting the rocks. There is no way to connect two different materials using links unless one of them is melted. So these rock chains prove that the ancient builders did in fact melt the rocks and changed its density like modern day alloys.
What?
I mean, this is, I mean, I have a whole series now of really mystical things in India, so this is one of them, you know, how, first of all, to build stone chains like, or cut them out. Maybe you could do it if you're a really good stone carver. But two different kinds of rocks combined like that. I mean, he says that they melted. I mean, he doesn't know. Could be mystical power, could be anything. I don't know.
Not only like that, but in a structure.
Yeah.
It's not only that you melt two links together and it's like on the floor or like on the table, but it's like,
yeah, how
something
do you, how
that
do you
is
do
like
that?
Hanging and you're melting it up there.
Yeah. So
the least which is quite evident is the stone chain. And even that you can't really make. You have to have some motivation to
I mean that's so let's see what is next here.
In this video I'm gonna show you some solid evidence of ancient machining technology at Hoysaleswara Temple. There's something very strange about these pillars. If you look closely, you can see these minute circular marks all around the pillar. These are created as a result of machining the pillar on a lathe. This process is called turning. There's no way to achieve this with chisels and hammers manually. If you look at these pillars, it is crystal clear that they were made with machines. In fact, archaeologists agree that these pillars were created in a lathe, but offer no convincing explanation as to how these huge pillars were machined 900 years ago. Nowadays, we are able to create these fascinating grooves and designs on a lathe, but machining a 12-foot tall stone pillar would be a very difficult job even today. So, how were these pillars created with amazing perfection in ancient times?
Just one note on this, he gave, how did they do it 900 years ago? So I'd say we should have a little reservation when dates are given. You know, they should all be taken with a grain of salt.
And I'm just going to give you one example of that.
So I'm just look a little at the dating of the Buddha example there. You know, I mean, this is... of course, these are the standard dates, and I think all of us could, if someone asked, you know, when was Buddha living?
500 years before Christ.
Yeah, you say, here they are. So, that's, we all learned that, that's, everyone accepts that. How did they derive these dates? Anyone knows? Here's a question mark. Actually, the dating of the Buddha goes back to the 1700s, to the... famous Indologist William Jones, if you're aware of him.
Mm-hmm.
William Jones, he was the first Englishman who learned Sanskrit, and he was extremely knowledgeable in language. He knew Sanskrit, he knew Latin, he knew Greek, he knew many other languages. He's the one who discovered the Indo-European connection. And it goes back to his discovery. He discovered that the, you know, European languages, Indian languages, belong to the same group of languages, and he was also the one who took the fact that Alexander the Great he conquered India or came to India something like 2000 BC or something like, no, not 200 BC. And he was stopped by Chandragupta. They met. Yeah, Chandragupta, Alexander. Chandragupta supposedly stopped the onward march of Alexander. So we know the exact year of Alexander, and then we can combine it with Chandragupta, and then you can actually go back and look at this causes of William Jones. Buddha came is before in the dynasty of Chandragupta, whom William Jones assumed was Chandragupta Maurya. You know Chandragupta Maurya, you know Chanakya Pandit, like that. Mm.
So the Buddha's family was the predecessor of Chandragupta.
Yeah.
The previous dynasty.
Yeah, he's born in the same dynasty. It's a previous generation, something like that. I don't know exact dynasty. I don't have, but
same dynasty but previous generation.
Yeah, something like that. So, so that was how William Jones see David the Buddha. However, there are reasons to think that Jones got it wrong, because there's not only one Chandragupta. Just like
now you have Chandragupta and then Chandragupta, like two different names.
Yeah, the name is Chandragupta. It's one name, Chandragupta. But just like in Norway, you have what are the names of kings here? At least in Denmark, I take Denmark. In Denmark, you have Christian 1, Christian 2, Christian 3, mm-hmm. and you have Frederick 1, Frederick 2, mm-hmm. Frederick 3. And it's not the only one Christian, one Frederick. Or like
Tsar Nikolai II.
Yeah,
first.
Yeah. So, there's more than one Chandragupta. Mm-hmm. That's the point. Did he get the right Chandragupta? And as it looks like, actually, he didn't get the right Chandragupta. Here is Alexander the Great was conquered by Chandragupta. Or this is Greek. We have some Greek records. With Greek names of the Indian kings, Chandragupta, but everyone agrees that must be Chandragupta. And then again, which Chandragupta? Chandragupta Maurya was preceded by Mahapadmananda and succeeded by Bindusara. Mm-hmm. Chandragupta Gupta, there's a different dynasty. There's a Gupta dynasty and a Maurya dynasty. Chandragupta Gupta was preceded by Chandrasri and succeeded by Samudra Gupta. Mm-hmm. According to Greek records, Chandragupta was preceded by Chandramas and succeeded by Chandragupta. So there, you know, the names are much more similar to Chandragupta Gupta than to Chandragupta Maurya. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, and there are those who are looking into that, there are several other evidence actually point to that simply he got the wrong Chandragupta. And if this is correct, then history has to be, Buddha has to just pushed further back. Actually, the whole thing has to be pushed 1200 years back. That means Buddha was not here 500 years before Christ. We have to go back to like 1800 before Christ. And whole Indian histories is affected by that. So this would be if this is correct, this would be the actual date of the Buddha. And it's interesting, it also moves everyone. Shankara, if you know Shankara Acharya, mm-hmm. normally it says 600 after Christ, he would be 800 before Christ. And that also makes sense, because Alexander did not come to a Buddhistic India, he came to a Hindu India. We know that because there were Greeks who became
Hindu.
Yeah, Hindus, devotees of Vasudeva. So if it was a Hindu India, that indicates actually Shankara must already have been there and driven Buddhism away from India at that time. And also, it suddenly connects, because that has been the criticism of Europeans have criticized Indians, saying that Indians, they were not very good at chronology. They didn't consider it important to accurately record names of the kings and like that. And therefore, the chronologies you have in the Vedic literature, texts and like that, they are completely off, in the Mahabharata and like that. But suddenly when you move it 1200 years back, things start falling into place. So that was just, I mean, my point. When we hear dates, even on these videos, this is an Indian. He's very good, Praveen Mohan, but he gives also like standard dates. They should be taken with a grain of salt. They can be much older.
You have some more information about this speaker? What is his background to speak?
This Praveen Mohan?
Yeah.
He's a little on. I mean, you could. He's
making all these videos.
Yeah. He's from an Indian background, Indian family, raised as a, you know, in a Hindu family, but he was raised in America, in Detroit. But now he travels around the world and studies history and makes videos about that. And he's in India and studying, looking at temples and coming up with many interesting points. But he hasn't informed his actual background. He's been on alien. What's called national? What is called
the ancient aliens?
Ancient Ink Channel. He has been on a program there, but he tells a little. But yeah. I mean, he's not. Yeah.
There is also an option with columns. It's describing that they are reused from even older
temples
that might have been destroyed. And
easily.
He doesn't go in. I've seen the video. I don't think he goes into that opportunity and that option.
No.
It's obviously, it could be much older.
Easily. Because how do you date stone anyway? You cannot date stones. So,
can we say that it's mostly this Christianity which like has blocked all this information for so many years?
Christians were much motivated by the idea that the Bible said the earth is only 6,000 years old. And then there was the flood of Noah, 4,000 years old, so there can be no civilization before 4,000 years old. That's
the fundamentalist, some fundamentalist Christians that believe that. But actually, if you look at some lineage, you can date the flood, because there are different, how you calculate.
Mm.
So if you calculate the flood, supposedly it didn't happen. The flood was actually much older.
Mm.
The flood is actually could be dated to 12,000 years ago, corresponding to Atlantis, the fall of Atlantis. So there are even inside of the Christian community, some say 6,000, and some people say it's much older.
But the point is that still, I mean, that this idea that, a lot of the, in one sense, misdating goes back to Christians actually wanting the whole thing to fit into a biblical account. How's everyone feeling? Are you tired or is it okay? I absolutely want to show you, and have something I can show you. Should I show everything?
Yes.
Okay. Just let me know if you're getting tired.
So here are, okay. I think there's 3-4 more short clips for this Praveen Mohan being at different places in India.
Here you can see a very strange device in the hands of a god called Masana Bhairava. This clearly represents a type of year mechanism called planetary gears. The outer gear has 32 teeth, and the inner gear has exactly half the number, or 16 teeth, which is precisely how we use reduction gears today. If this were just an imaginary tool, how could the ancient sculptors come up with this gear ratio of 2-1? Even more interesting, we can also see a fastener that goes around this mechanism and is locked in the center. Today, we use the exact same technology. We use something called a circlet lock or a snap ring to keep these things in place. If historians are right, how could primitive people working with chisels and hammers imagine such a mechanism? Let's go into the deep, dark areas of the temple and see if we can find more evidence. Here's a 7-foot-tall god with the most uncanny ornaments. His crown is adorned with skulls, which are less than 1 inch wide. I realized that I could pass a small twig through one eye and it would come out through the ear on the other side. The twig can also be passed from ear to ear and also ear to mouth and any way you want. What does that mean? It means that the entire skull is hollow inside. It is impossible to remove the inside of a small sphere, which is only 1 inch wide. Even with modern machines, this would be very difficult, but we know for a fact that creating a hollow sphere inside of such a small rock is impossible with primitive tools. Even more interesting, we can shine a flashlight between his head and crown, and the light shines through. There is a very small gap between the head and the crown. I tried to slide the same twig, which is about 3 millimeters wide, but it would not go through. This means that the gap is less than 3 millimeters wide. How could anyone create a small gap less than 3 millimeters wide with chisels? Is it possible that the small skulls, crown, and other pieces were carved out of separate rocks and then fixed together? No. Archaeologists confirm that this 7-foot-tall figure is made out of one solid rock.
So, again, I think it's Hoysalasvara, you know that temple?
Okay. So. I've heard of it.
Okay. I think the next thing is going to be a construction in India that's even more amazing than the Big Pyramid, more extensive than the Big Pyramid in Egypt.
We are in our case in India, and I'll show you the real reason why it was not built by ancient human beings with chisels and hammers. If all these structures were built by scooping out rocks from mountains, where did all the removed rocks go? The real puzzling fact is that even if you search around Ellora Caves, you won't find any large pile of rocks. According to archaeologists, what you see in Ellora is 34 different structures, all created by scooping out rocks from mountains. In case you're not familiar, there are no natural caves in Ellora, but all the mountains were simply converted into artificial caves. Let's stick with conventional history for a little bit and see if it makes any sense. If human beings did, in fact, carve these mountains, there should be enough debris of rocks to build at least an entire mountain. For example, this is the Kailasa temple, and all the space that's empty was originally made of rocks, and they were scooped out. In fact, the amount of rock scooped out is more than the amount of rock that is still standing. In many of the 34 structures, this is the case where the amount of rock removed outweighs the amount of rock that we can still see. What this actually means is that if we can get a hold of these removed rocks, we can build a structure larger than Ellora Caves. In modern earth moving, you can see huge piles of rocks left over even for a small project. So how much removed rocks are we talking about? In just Kailasa Temple alone, archaeologists estimate that over 400,000 tons of rocks were scooped out, and this is just from one temple. Imagine the amount of rock removed from 34 temples. If we do a conservative estimate by multiplying 400,000 by 20 and not 34, the volume of rock removed from Ellora Caves is an astounding 3 million cubic meters. So imagine this. If you take all the leftover rocks, you can build the entire pyramid of Giza, and you would still have 500,000 cubic meters of rocks remaining. But what do we find in Ellora? None.
Laura is a really amazing player, another amazing player.
Yeah, there is not any rocks nearby.
No, you can find there's no trace of that rock that was removed.
Maybe they shipped it off and built temples somewhere else.
Something, but it's
like with the mamas.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean,
maybe they built the pyramids with them.
No, they have not.
Have you been?
No.
The mamas.
This is really long.
Yes.
Yeah. It's on UNESCO's list of, you know, World Heritage Sites and like that.
But the circle with the teeth on it, it doesn't have to be a mechanical tool. It could be a symbol of as a spiritual significance with a...
Maybe.
Like a chakra or...
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, that's... He gives that as, you know, as his opinion. I'm not saying his opinions are absolute or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just interesting. Here comes another one about some little advanced technology.
Show you the recreation of an electric battery which was used in ancient India. This battery was described by a sage called Agastya, who lived at least 4,000 years ago, and what I'm making is according to what's being described in the ancient text called Agastya Samhita.
So
you can see that what's mentioned in the ancient text is actually capable of making electricity. Remember, we read in history books that the electric battery was created just 200 years ago by a man called Alessandro Volta. But Sage Agastya created this battery at least 4,000 years ago. But what's really strange is that Alessandro Volta uses pretty much the same materials for creating the quote-unquote very first battery. He uses copper, zinc, and instead of using copper sulfate, he uses sulfuric acid. Now, going back to the ancient text, Agastya says, use 100 containers and you can create a very effective force. Here, you can see that I used 3 pots in series, and you can see that the voltage increases up to more than 3 volts. Now, if I connect a small LED bulb, let's see if it works. There you go. You see, the small LED bulb actually glows with just 3 of these pots. This is a very interesting point that the ancient text mentions using multiple cells in series to increase the voltage. The natural question is, why was this used? Why did ancient people use multiple containers to produce high voltage electricity? Did they use it for lighting purposes, just like modern days?
So, I mean, I cut some things out of, but it's... I think it's quite obvious what he did. There's a description in Agastya Samhita that seems like, you know, a description of how you make a battery, and he tries to do it, and actually turns out he creates a battery. So the Vedic scriptures, they actually have descriptions of batteries, and so that proves actually they had electricity in those days. Not only had they electricity, they also had stainless steel.
Yeah.
You know about this example of stainless steel?
This is the ancient iron pillar of India. It has many baffling features which have not been explained till date. One of the strangest features is that it has not rusted for more than 1,000 years.
I'm just going to stop because... But it is outside Delhi.
in a, what is now a Muslim, yeah, there is a, this enormous iron pillar that has been there for probably several thousand years, and it has not rusted at all. Stainless steel was invented around the year 1900. It took a lot of...
In Germany.
Probably it was in Germany, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And but many were working on it. It wasn't like something an accidental or like no. that. There were you know,
dedicated
physicists and a lot of capital by really trying to find a combination to find the an alloy that would be in a stainless steel. So but here you have in India, and I've been told it's not only one place, there are four of them placed. Are you aware of the other? Smir Krishnaswamy, I showed this to him, he said actually there are four in different places in India. But this one is very famous. So again, India itself has so much evidence of what was not just some primitive hunters and gatherers.
They even talk about nuclear power.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. They talk about weapons being capable of destroying entire continents. And
Brahmastras are there.
Brahmastras are there.
So much. So again, I'm just giving you, very small samples of what's actually there. I wanted to shift the topic a little to go to America, because as we read that there is supposed, according to Srila Prabhupada, there was Vedic culture worldwide, and so one obvious question would be about America. Actually, one devotee, he wrote a book about searching for Vedic India worldwide, and it's a quite good book. But one thing he did not discuss was America. He doesn't even mention it. And for me, one obvious question is, so what about America? Was there also Vedic culture in America? So I'll have a little look at that. First, here's something that I don't know exactly how relevant it is. It shows that what we learn, what we have thought about America may not be absolutely true. This is something about the Amazon rainforest. And as we all know, the Amazon is, of course, it's been massively cut down. I guess still it's the largest virgin forest that no civilization has touched. It's just has been there for millions of years or something like that. Isn't that, that's kind of our understanding of the Amazon. It's wrong. Amazon is not a virgin forest. Amazon is not a place that has never been inhabited. And this is mainstream science. You have this here from, this is just over 1 year ago. Yeah. Actually, the whole Amazon area, that's standard scientists, they have concluded that now, it's actually a huge cultivated area. The forest is more like a plantation area, and enormous, and the fertility has been massively improved by human activity, and there were cities, there were civilizations, everything has been there. 500 years ago, it was a massive genocide all over America on the indigenous people by the Europeans. A lot of people were massacred also in the Amazon, and even more were killed actually by diseases,
yes,
spread by the Europeans. That seems to be what most died from in the Amazon area. But Amazon is not it's not a virgin area. It was lots of civilization.
Indo-Europeans, we have strong immune systems.
Mm.
We carry very often. We can resist different types of bacteria.
Yeah.
And
obviously, because the way we live, only the most hardiest people can survive our lifestyle.
Yes.
So obviously, we must have resistance, even survive the way we live.
Yeah.
Living on meat, living on beer,
yeah,
living in no hygiene.
So they said that when I've been reading about the spread of
the genealogy when the spread of the different tribes, and they said that stronger, taller, paler people when they came eastwards. You can see that we have the R1 haplogroup. It survives certain places in the east, where the reason they survived was because of they had stronger immune system and more resilience.
Yeah.
It's written like that.
Yeah.
But your immune system is failing in India. Yeah. All Europeans get sick.
Yeah.
But our immune system is more similar than if you compare it to, let's say, natives living in the Americas.
Mm.
So
of course, then they got back on us, and they gave us tobacco that's killing everyone here. So we killed them by our diseases, and they gave us our tobacco, and we've been killed by that. So this way, you know, it goes forth.
It goes back and forth.
So, but the real point is, I think I put it in here just to, just to show that, you know, what we thought we knew, but actually, what we thought was basically wrong. Otherwise, I don't know if this is real. What is the point here? But yeah.
That's stupid.
So that's the question: is what about Vedic culture in America? And actually, there's so much evidence that even though the historians had the idea that the American cultures, and here we're talking about the Incas, the Aztecs, the Mayans, the Olmecs, whatever you name them, they arose independently in America. They were not connected with Asian cultures or anything like that. America was populated by people crossing from Siberia into 30, Alaska.
30,000 years ago, they say.
Yeah, sometimes 30,000 years, sometimes, I mean, that's debated, but something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. When Siberia was connected to Alaska, then again, Stone Age people, hunters, gatherers, they crossed the land bridge, and they were actually remaining in Alaska for quite some time until the ice melted. Then they were able to, maybe 10,000 years ago, move down in North America, Central America, finally South America, and all the cultures arose independently. But actually, there are other historians, again, you know, professional historians who in the past and even today would say this must be wrong, and say actually no, it must be they're connected with the Indian cultures, or let's say the Southeast Asian cultures, but that's also Indian, you know, Southeast Asia means like Thailand and Indonesia and Vietnam,
Cambodia. Angkor Wat.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is
yeah.
Southeast Asian,
yeah.
But
the whole Vedic culture was covering that area. And I look little of the evidence that points to that. That is better explained by that idea than that the cultures arose independently. Here is one example. This is the man here to the right. His name is Ganapati Stapati, and in the 90s, I don't know if he's still living, but in the 90s he was the leading Vastu architect of India, you know, of traditional Indian architecture. And he went on a trip to America and looked at some of the famous structures in America, such as Machu Picchu. And here is a report. This is from Hinduism Today in June 1995. It says, C.V. Ganapati Stapati read Devarandian's facts to our Hawaii editorial office from Machu Picchu, high in the rugged Andes Mountains of Peru, South America. Oh, yes, okay, C.V. Ganapati Stapati has just measured with tape, compass, and a layout story board two ancient Incan structures at Machu Picchu, a temple and a residence. He has confirmed that the layout of these structures, location for doors, windows, proportions of width to length, roof styles, degree of slopes for roofs, column sizes, wall thicknesses, etc., all conform completely to the principles and guidelines as prescribed in the Vastu Shastras of India. Residential layouts identical to those found in Mohenjo-Daro,
the temple layouts are identical to those that he's building today and that can be found all over India.
Right.
So he found that Machu Picchu is built according to Vastu, Mayan buildings are built according to Vastu. So, I mean, that cannot just be chance, obviously. Here, if you compare many of Indian temple structures, they're very much identical to Central American structures. You know, you can call them pyramids, but I mean, they're built according to the same kind of architecture. India has a game, board game called Pachisi. Do you know Pachisi? Is that
Pachisi?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they, Mexico, they had the same. Mm. I mean, when the Europeans came to Mexico, the Mexicans or the Aztecs were playing the same, the Patoli. So they were common. These are on temples in America, South America, and they have elephant heads. You find elephant heads in buildings in America, and these elephants also, they are not mammoths. I mean, America had the mammoths, but not in South America. So they're not mammoths. They're not African elephants. They are Indian elephants. Elephant heads like that. Yeah. And there's much more. There's so much.
And there were no elephants in South America, as far as we know.
No.
So it must have been a cultural aesthetics that they brought with them from.
Yeah,
just like the
lion.
Motherland.
Just like the lion in Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there were lions in
Europe. Yeah, and there were lions in America actually also. Yeah. If you go back far back enough, maybe they had elephants also.
Maybe.
You know, I mean.
Maybe they brought the elephants with them.
Yeah, yeah. 2,000 years ago, in India, they had ships that could easily cross the Pacific Ocean.
Mm.
They had ships that were bigger than what Columbus used to cross the Atlantic. Indians were extremely advanced sailors and seafarers 2,000 years ago and further back. And there's no keep aside Bhimana's mystic power, even just with the ships that they had in the past India, they could easily cross the Pacific and have traffic that way. And as I say, there are historians who think this is much more probable that this what was going on than this independent rise of these two cultures.
Later on, we know that
when it comes to migrating to America,
there's
actually evidence that in North America, for 20,000 years ago, that there was a migration from Europe to America, crossing using the ice. Using the ice on the Atlantic Ocean as help, and then crossing over only using small boats made from whale skin, like the Inuits.
Yeah. I mean, that's again we're into a big topic, but there's so much evidence that Columbus was not the first. Of course, we know the Vikings were there.
Yes,
but also. I mean, there's so much evidence that, you know, Egyptians have been there, Phoenicians have been there, and...
Carthaginians.
Who?
Carthaginians are Phoenicians.
Oh, yeah.
There?
Carthaginians are Phoenicians.
Okay, that's the same.
And Celts. Also.
Carthage was a Phoenician colony.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
But also Celts.
Yeah.
Celts?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Also, one interesting evidence is that, when was that? 15 years ago, something like that. One of the leading German, she's a specialist in tracing rocks. You know, she's a kind of a chemist that works mainly for the police, tracing drugs and like such as cocaine, hashes, mm-hmm. tobacco, like that, in criminal cases. But she was put on the task of studying Egyptian mummies to see if they were also using some kind of drugs. And to her surprise, she discovered that, they were using hashes, not only that, but also cocaine and tobacco. Yeah, but that was in Egypt. So there was no cocaine or tobacco officially in Egypt, but she found it's there. and it didn't come from any external contamination. Actually, the mummies had traces of cocaine inside them. So that means they must have had connection to America at that time. And Anyway, I mean, there's
it's a huge topic, but it's I mean, the idea that Vedic culture was worldwide is not at all unreasonable. It actually fits much better with the evidence as you look at it than the idea that these cultures they arose independently.
I think one of the reasons why modern so-called scientists and archaeologists can't accept it, or have a hard time accepting it, is that it goes against the underlying ideology or religious belief of progress.
Also that, yeah.
We're living in a modern paradigm. The way we understand the world
is the most advanced.
That we're the most advanced, and we're only getting more and more advanced, and it's only getting better, and you only get more advanced.
Yeah.
So if you say that there was a higher civilization before, it means that it was a fall, and that we've actually been degrading, which is going against the narrative, that the established narrative of the way we understand, like the established way of understanding in the modern mindset.
Yeah. Oh, it's true. So, I want to have the last thing, and then we kind of wind up from here. I have something about dating of Buddha and like that. I'll conclude with something about dating of the Vedas and dating of Mahabharata and the Bhagavad Gita and like that. And even just the authenticity of the Veda. Also is related is the Vedic writings is just, you know, writings of, you know, mythology like that, or is it actually, are they actually historical texts? Many things is just, you know, we're just dealing with mythology. Here's one man who thinks that. Gandhi once said, generally Mahabharata is taken to be historical work, but not in my opinion. It is not so. I cannot say that Ramayana and Mahabharata are historical works. They are simply religious works. If you are still inclined to treat them as historical works, then I should say that they are nothing but the history of the self, Atma, that do not contain what happened thousands of years ago.
I think it's wrong.
You think it's wrong?
Yes.
Very good. You belong here. Welcome. Gandhi also said, Krishna of Gita is the embodiment of pure and divine knowledge, but without having any physical existence. By this, the avatar Krishna is not denied at all, but only it is said that he is mythical.
Very political.
So,
but how can the knowledge of, where does it come from, the knowledge of the Gita?
That's a good question.
How can it be the embodiment of pure and divine knowledge if Krishna wasn't here? It's such a nonsense thing to say.
Yeah. You ask him.
He was killed, right?
Yeah. So, here's another one. Ramayana and Mahabharata do not have any historical value. These two epics are simply mythology and nothing but poet's fancy. Neither Ram nor Krishna was historical personality, and both of them were simply mythical.
But something can be mystical in mythology and have happened at the same time. It's not mutually exclusive.
No. Let's have a look at it. I mean, I'm not going to end with this. I mean, I'm not stating my opinion. Mm-hmm. I'm just, you know.
No. I know. I understand you're not stating your opinion. I'm just addressing this nonsense.
Let's have a look at this here. I mean, I think that this will, you know, put this to rest. This idea. Because actually, there have been, within the last 20 years, there have been scientists who have looked into the dating of the Mahabharata. And that something very interesting has come out of that. There is some very specific evidence in the Mahabharata which can be tested now. It could not be tested 20 years ago or before that, but now we can test it. And these are astronomical astronomical facts in the Mahabharata. There's a lot of astronomy in the Mahabharata. For example, here, this is just before the Battle of Kurukshetra starts. And is described that Krishna, he leaves Hastinapur. As you may know, Krishna went on the instruction of Yudhisthira to Duryodhana to negotiate for peace, and he goes to Hastinapur. And he's there with Duryodhana, but Duryodhana, he refuses the peace offer. Then Krishna, he goes back, and then the war starts. So this is just when Krishna is leaving Hastinapur. It says, Krishna leaves Hastinapur on the day of Uttara Palguni. Karna accompanies him in his chariot and has a long conversation with him. And Karna, he gives some lot of astronomical information here. During the conversation, Karna describes some omens that he has seen that indicate a great harm to the Kuru family, which include the following. Shyani is afflicting Rohini, and Garaka has performed a retrograde motion before reaching Jyeshta, and is prograde again, having passed Anuradha. The moon had lost all its luster on the full moon of Kartik, and the solar eclipse will appear to take place next new moon day. At the end of the conversation, Krishna sends a message to Bhishma and Drona through Karna that 7 days from that day there is going to be an Amavasya at Jyeshta, and that war rituals be started on that day. And then says, this must be the Amavasya that Karna refers to as the eclipse day. Let's see if we... Yeah. Okay. Just some basic astronomy. I mean, is everyone familiar with how astronomy works and like that, what is referred to here? Of course, when you speak astronomy, we observe basically two movements on the... on the sky. You have the 24-hour movement of you know, the whole thing moving. But then also there's the yearly movement, where you can see the sun moving through different constellations through the year. And then also, of course, you have the what you can for the yearly movement. You have what you can call the fixed stars. That's called the fixed stars. They don't move. They're the constellation. They're simply there, and they don't change. But then you have different bodies, heavenly bodies that are moving. You see the sun is moving through different constellations. You see the moon. You see the other planets. There's Venus. There's Mercury. There's Mars. There's Jupiter. Saturn, basically, they are moving through different constellations, and you can calculate both forth and back what will be where, which planet will be where. So here we have some constellations that these were, of course, you had the Sanskrit names here, but I think here it says, let's just try to translate this. Shani is Saturn. Rohini is Antares. Yeah. I think it's the star called Antares. Angaraka is Mars. Jyeshta is Jyeshta is a star, and I think it's
a nakshatra.
It's a star.
That's also nakshatra.
Yeah. And which star? Let me just see. There is Aldebaran, and there's Antares. And anyway, these are names of stars. And Mars is making a retrograde motion. Most of the time, planets, you look at them and they move from west to east. Just like the daily motion you see from east to west, you see the sun moving from east to west. Sun rises in the east, in the south, in the west. But the yearly motion is the other way, goes the other way, west to east. Most of the time. But then when sometimes you follow Mars, and then you'll see it stops for a day or so, then it moves backwards for a couple of days, and then again it moves forwards. That's called a retrograde motion. And if you look at it heliocentric, then it is when you have the sun in the center, and you have the Earth moving, and you have Mars out here moving, when kind of the Earth overtakes Mars, mm-hmm. then it looks like that.
Yeah.
So that's what it. So that's what's been. So that's been referred to. Then there is a lunar eclipse given. There's solar eclipse given, and actually this is not mentioned here. There's a second lunar eclipse within 1 month. You have two lunar eclipses and one solar eclipse.
It so can only happen at a very specific conjunction.
That can only happen at a very specific conjunction, and we'll have now. You'll see a little about this, about this calculation here.
Discovered that the most significant supporting evidence of this war, evidence of Dwarka, evidence of ancient technology, and evidence of Krishna's existence actually came from astronomical references, which were discovered by Dr. Narahari Achar, a professor of physics at the University of Memphis, who is the world's foremost researcher of the astronomical events described in the ancient texts. Traditionally, Indians have believed that the war took place about 3000 BC, but modern scholars who have a more critical approach to the study of the epics take a different view. Professor Achar said that there are many types of astrological events referred to in these ancient texts, consisting of eclipses and comets and conjunctions of planets with different stars. The most intriguing part of these astrological events is the appearance of two fiery comets. Professor Achar identified in the Mahabharata that there were two comets with blazing coppery red heads. These two comets were mentioned in not just one book, but two of the books of the Mahabharata, namely the Udyoga and the Bhishma Parvas. In conjunction with these comets, he noted that the texts also mention that Saturn was at Aldebaran, and that Mars performed a retrograde motion near Antares. Professor Achar then used several different pieces of astronomy software to determine the date in the Mahabharata and the existence of Dwarka. These pieces of software enabled him to view the night sky as if it would have appeared any time in the past, and so he painstakingly reproduced the exact night sky for every single reference in the Mahabharata. A lunar eclipse occurred in the month of Kartika and took place at Pylades, which is located in the constellation of Taurus. After this occurs, the Mahabharata mentions that it is followed by a solar eclipse near Antares. Dr. Achar took this evidence and searched for the years 3500 BC to about 500 AD and found there are 137 such conjunctions where Saturn is at Aldebaran. When we see Saturn's transit at Aldebaran, it's usually an event which is even today considered by Indian astrologers to be associated with great wars and violent events. Dr. Achar then searched for years in which Mars performed a retrograde motion near Antares. It turns out that this reduces the dates from 137 to just 17. After narrowing this down to just 17 dates, he looked for years where there was a lunar eclipse in the month of Kartika, and this reduced the set from 17 to just 2. These 2 years identified by Professor Achar were 2183 BC and 3067 BC. One last final piece of conclusive evidence solved this puzzle. In 2183 BC, the winter solstice occurred in the waning phase of the moon. In 3067 BC, it occurred in the waxing phase, and the waxing phase is exactly what was written in the Mahabharata and what Dr. Achar was looking for. A careful study of these ancient scriptures yields data about a third eclipse in October of 3067 BC, which follows the solar eclipse at an interval of 13 days, exactly how the epic describes it. The evidence presented by Professor Achar overwhelmingly pinpoints 3067 BC as the year when the great battle described in the ancient texts of the Mahabharata took place. Because the astronomical dates and the events described in the Mahabharata have been authenticated by modern scientific method, it is reasonable to conclude that the Mahabharata itself is a factual description of events that took place during that time.
that was. Actually, he doesn't get all the this video doesn't get all the details. I mean, I've read what actually Professor Achaz is actually what he writes, and there are more details. I mean, he gets even a couple of these not I think little wrong, but the point is still the conclusion is correct. Not only did Professor Achaz calculate for the date of the before the start of the Mahabharata war. Also, Krishna's disappearance was 36 years later. He found that also there, the astronomical information corresponds to, you know, to actually what happened there. So that's quite convincing evidence. I mean, we're not just dealing with some mythical scriptures or anything like that. Nobody could, thousands of years later, have written, just some fantasy, some fantastic fantasy, say it is, and then put in exact astronomical information like that. That's simply not possible. That was kind of the last thing I had. Any last questions or comments? I think everyone is ready for Prasadam.
Are you doing some more traveling, Prabhu, in this field?
Oh, I hope I can.